The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by HP Instant Ink. No one is reading your mind. But HP Instant Ink knows when your printer is running low and sends new cartridges before you run out. So you never have to think about ink. For details, visit hp.com/instantinkSpotify. Conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options, and now your customers have a new option in the way they pay, with PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan and start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/us/getQR code.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 60 of the Washed Up Emo Podcast. I'm Tom Mullen. This episode, we welcome Brian Lowett. Brian Lowett started Love It Records and works at Discord. How awesome is that job? Love It Records start out in 95, and they put out some amazing bands, some of my favorites, including Engine Down, 400 Years, Mile Marker, and in the background, Sleepy Time Trio. Brian also shed light on working at Discord, and we spent a good chunk of time talking about the festival Mac Rock that we both attended. Search out this label, search out these bands, and keep digging, and wait for the breakdown. You grew up in Northern Virginia, correct?
I did.
And, you know, obviously being so connected, was going into D.C., was going to shows. Was that like a big event, or is it something that you just sort of always felt you needed to do? I don't know. Sometimes, you know, D.C. to me, when I first went, I was like, oh, my God, this place is crazy. There's so much going on. Or, you know, maybe my first time to the 930 Club. For you, what was it about, you know, if it was, you know, getting into the scene? Was it even then, or did it take, did you have to go to college first to sort of understand what was going on?
I had a friend in who I grew up with from, like, I guess I started becoming friends with him in third or fourth grade. My dad passed away when I was in elementary school, and one of my my mom was a teacher at the elementary school, and one of her, like, co-teachers, she basically helped my mom sometimes watch after school. Like, I'd go to his house, and, like, so we just became good friends because of it, and he lived down the street. And then, so I think around, he started getting into hardcore music, like, I don't know, maybe in seventh grade. So then he like, made me a mix of, like, some stuff he was, like, listening to, and then I just got, like, really into it, and kind of helped, I don't know, it kind of was one of those things where I was like, holy shit, like, this is amazing. Like, it kind of just opened this, like, weird world I didn't know existed in a way.
What was on it?
It was a lot of, like, Revelation hardcore and, like, you know, California stuff. It was a lot more East Coast stuff. I mean, West Coast stuff than East Coast stuff. But, yeah, it was kind of all over the place. I don't remember exactly, but it was probably, like, Youth of Today and Judge and a lot of those type of bands. Was Shelter around then? It was stuff more like that. Like,
yeah.
Like, more Ravenite. Eagle Vision type stuff.
And then, right?
Yeah, so then I don't know. So then I was just like, holy shit, like, this is amazing. Because it was one of the things where I was never kind of like a normal kid. And, I never felt like I fully fit into like one thing. So it just kind of opened this world to me where I was like, oh, this is really exciting. It's not only do I really like the music, but it's kind of, it's its own like, you know, scene. It's its own community. So yeah, I started going to shows and then started going to, I mean, at this point, I don't know what my first show exactly was. I guess it was probably 8th or 9th grade. And, yeah, I used to go to, like, in D.C., there were all the Positive 4 shows that were, like, in church basements and, you know, just kind of all over the place, like day matinee shows. Yeah, I go to shows at the 930 Club. A lot of times I would take Metro. I mean, I lived in Northern Virginia, but it was only a few stops outside of D.C. on the Metro. So I would take, you know, Metro and, or, like, sometimes prior to driving, like, one of our friends' parents might drop us off outside the club and then pick us back up or something. It feels like it's the old 930 Club, which is kind of funny thinking about it now. But, and then, of course, when you start driving, you drove yourself. But, yeah, so I went to, like, every show possible, basically, at that point. And I used to go into Georgetown a lot and go to all the punk record stores and just bought, like, records all the time. And, yeah, so I just got, like, pretty into it.
And were you just like, I mean, was there a certain, you know, was it still the, you know, was it straight edge hardcore stuff? Was it more of the, you know, was it like post at that time? Like what things were really, you know, sort of connecting with you band wise, or was it just everything?
It was kind of everything. Like if it was like a, you know, like a punk show, I was into it. I was never like someone that really was into like the mosh pit and kind of more violent, like mm-hmm. pushing type shows. I mean, I went to plenty of shows where that stuff happened, but I definitely was probably more into like a Positive 4 show than like, I don't know, like maybe a matinee at like the Safari Club where there was like, you know, going to be total chaos.
Yeah.
So I probably got away from the Revelation stuff maybe a little bit as I kind of got more into it. I got more into like the, you know, like the more the Discord DC scene.
And what
I mean, it was honestly a little bit of every, I mean, it's kind of funny. I mean, even like indie rock, like Velocity Girl or whatever, it was just like, if it was like a part of the like local scene, like I was kind of going to it or like into it.
What about DC? Like, I think what about, you know, DC that if someone's, you know, you have a minute to like explain that scene because I've spent a lot of time there. It's so different from a Philly, a New York, a Boston, West Coast, Europe. There's just, I always felt that it was so tight of a community. Like, you know, it was everyone knew everyone, or there was this like sense of community and that I didn't see anywhere else as much. I don't know if that was something that
everyone,
you felt.
I mean, yeah, I don't know if I'd gotten into like, yeah, I don't know if I had lived in, if I'd grown up in Philly or Boston, if I would have gotten into it as much because of the reasons you're stating. Like, I feel like there was definitely a sense of community and place in the DC scene and also a sense of like social responsibility. Like I felt, you know, the punk scene, a lot of it like also was like, you know, like getting people to volunteer, like the homeless shelter, or like, you know, Positive Force was doing all these great things and really pushing like for social change, which I was also interested in. And they gave you like easy ways of like, we're looking for people to do this on this Saturday or this. And I think it just kind of like, you know, it made it more of a community where it wasn't just like you go to a show and you leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, like when I went to start the label, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. So, you know, I asked, you know, people at Discord, I asked Simple Machines, and everyone was just always so helpful with sharing information. Like no one was just like, oh, this guy's going to come and take this band from me. They're going to do something that's kind of like compete with me. Like that was never, you know, what was coming out of DC. It was more like, hey, let's all help each other. And so, you know, whenever anyone asks me how to do things, I tried to go, I mean, it's hard now if you get so many emails, but I try to go out of my way to like return the favor whenever I can with sharing information and stuff that I know some people just don't like to do. Cause I'm just like, you know, I had to start somewhere and everyone was helpful to me. So, you know, and everyone, you know, there's kind of the greater good. So I think DC was always about that. And it just made it a little bit maybe more special than some other music scenes. I mean, and the music was obviously great too.
Yeah, that's the other part. There were so many fucking good bands. I mean, I just, like, when I was at work today, I was like, you know what? I'm going to look at the Discord, records catalog. You just scroll again because, you know, you forget some over the time and you just start reading them and you're like, oh, my God, that era, this band, or this era, this band. And it, you just start to kind of.
Especially in the 90s. Like,
yeah. Huge.
Yeah. And I mean, well, you know, a lot of those bands, like, you know, the shows would be crowded, but a lot of those bands weren't that big in the end. But they, you know, their music's pretty timeless.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is they're still mentioning, people still mention, you know, those bands. And it's, they're in whatever article gets mentioned about whatever genre, there's going to be a Discord band in there. And I think that's really interesting. And why do you feel that? Is it DC and the political? Is it because there's so many suburbs, you know, that are surrounding it with the Maryland and Virginia? Do you have any hypothesis on what was sort of happening or why there was such a continuous stream of it?
I mean, I think one is people are just supportive of music in DC, like musicians are supportive of each other. And I think people, you know, I think people are more willing maybe to play music. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think, well, I know like a place like New York, it's just more expensive to be in a band, let's say, because you pay a lot for a practice space, although DC's starting to get a little crazy with that stuff. But I think, you know, back in the day, like, it was just a lot easier and probably cheaper in DC to be a band than it was in maybe New York. But yeah, I think it's just, I think things just support each other. If you have, like, some bands that are really good, then every, you know, other people want to play music and be a part of it. And it just kind of circles around.
Yeah. And then when you went to school down in North Carolina at Guilford, and what was the, you know, it was funny, I was reading and you were at the radio station and I was doing the radio station stuff at the same time. It was that moment, those late 90s. I mean, college radio was still a pretty big deal. And you can
it
help.
Was. That was a great thing to be a part of. I mean, it that's definitely the thing I miss about North Carolina sometimes is, I guess it's, now you have internet radio, but it's kind of, it's not the same. Like, I don't know. I really like that in North Carolina, you could drive through the whole state and always get a good college radio station.
Yeah. We were,
all the way through the state. Like,
yeah.
Like 15, 20 of them. Like, it was amazing. You just keep going, you keep driving, you'd always find like someone playing really good music. You don't have that here.
There was that sense of unknown, or, you know, it wasn't like we had a message board for the radio station so we could tell. I remember being at the station I was at, WSOE, you know, we were, I think, four exits on I-40. You could hear us. I remember these kids calling in and they were like, oh, you played this band, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, where are you from? They're like, oh, we're in the high school. Like, the high school kids were listening.
We got that all the time. We got a couple of high school kids, one of which I actually still talk to now, but he, that would tape the radio show.
Yeah.
Because they would, like, that was their way of finding out about band, just because, and it, the first couple of times I heard it, it would just, like, blow my mind, because WKFS actually had a pretty good frequency, and you could get it into Virginia on a clear night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, which is funny, because people kept trying to take over the station, because it was, it had a good, it was 90.9, or it is 90.9, and I know that people...
Oh, you guys got that. That's pretty high up on the scale.
It is, yeah, and the frequency. So, the crazy thing within that, though, is we always had, for a little while, there was some Christian station that wanted to, like, take the call letter. So what they would do is they'd have people listen to the station 24/7, and every time someone would, like, say, you know, fuck, or, like, play a song with the word fuck or whatever, they'd report it.
Because
they had people just listening to the station, just looking for a mess up, and then they'd contact the FCC about it, because they were in, like, you know, after a couple months we found out, because the FCC sent us all these violations, and we had to, like, you know, the whole station went on notice, because it's like, well, they're just doing this because they're trying to get you guys all kicked off the whole station off the air because they want to take it over. And I was like, that's insane.
What year was this?
This would have probably been 95 or 96, I guess.
That is hilarious.
But I guess, you know, you can't just, if a new station wants to come on the air, you have to kick someone off, basically, or take someone over, because it's not like they just have empty frequencies.
Yeah.
So, they figured, I guess smartly, that a college station would be pretty easy pickings. But luckily the college was very supportive of the station, and they knew it was actually a selling point to certain students. So they made sure that they supported the station. But there were points where they're like, you guys have to clean up your act.
Wow.
But yeah, but I had a show that was after 10, so, you know, there were different rules.
Safe haven hours.
Yeah, but you still could get in trouble for certain things. But, I loved that 2 hours a week I got to do it. And
yeah.
It was great because I love learning about new music. And, you know, every label would send you stuff, and then you obviously got free records, but you got to listen to stuff first. And, yeah, it was great.
My favorite was probably the road trips to the shows playing the new music. So that, you know, whoever's driving, and they'd be like, Tom, what do you got this week? And I'm like, oh, I have X Band, and it's this. And they're like, where is it from? You know, and then you listen to it the whole way through. Or you're, whatever, maybe it's 30 minutes to Carrboro, and then, you know, another record on the way back. And it's, I guess, you know, it's the sense of an album is over, or the sense of having that much patience. But I vividly remember staring out a window listening to records, and I just think of me now doing that. It would be, I mean, how many social updates would I have done after the show?
Yeah, exactly. No, I definitely remember car trips going to shows. I remember driving to the Cradles. I guess it was probably it must have been Jawbreaker's last tour, and gain a speeding ticket. Like, I just remember certain things in going to shows. I remember one time with one of my friends, we drove from Greensboro to DC to see Fugazi play at the 9:30 Club, and we drove there, went to the show, hung out, and then drove back to be at a 8 a.m. class. And, you know, so it was like 10 hours of driving for 3 hours, but it was like worth it. But I mean, of course, I wouldn't do that now, but like, you know, those are the things.
And then? Oh, yeah. That's so funny you say that. I did the same thing for Sunny Day Real Estate at 9:30 Club.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. But those things are like, at the time, you're like, this is stupid, but you remember those things. And
you had to do it. It was Sunny Day, you know, or you had to do it. It was Fugazi.
Yeah, exactly. The radio station. Yeah, college radio really tied things together for me. I mean, that's why I was just like, well, but, you know, I was working at the station. I was just like, I wanted to be involved in, I played DC music in North, you know, like one of my shows I did, it was mostly, I was just playing DC music down there. And that was cool because then I got to bring some of the bands that I play down there to play at Dick Street or at the college or different places, and people had heard them. But then, you know, at some point I was just like, well, I'm not a musician, but I like being involved, and obviously I wasn't going to do the radio station after I left college, so I started kind of thinking about what I wanted to do, and then I was like, maybe I should put out records, and that's kind of how it came about. Like, I was just at the radio station thinking about it, and then,
Wow.
Yeah.
The first release was Monarchid, right?
Yep, yeah, it was the Monarchid 7-inch, and I didn't really know those guys. I actually just, I can't remember who gave me their contact, but I just called them up, and I was just like, look, I'm starting this label, and I want to put out a 7-inch by you guys. I'd seen them play a bunch of times. Well, maybe not. They hadn't played a bunch of times. I should take that back, but I'd probably seen them like 5 or 6 times. And they had been in a previous band called Orchid, and then I was just like, why is no one putting this out? So I was like, look, I'm going to start a label. I want to put out a 7-inch by your band. I know that's kind of crazy because, you know, I don't have any records out or whatever, but this is kind of how I want to do it. And they're like, that's cool. So they're like, yeah, let's do it. I was like, huh? So, that was the first release.
And you probably learned a lot at that time because it wasn't like you just uploaded it to fucking Bandcamp.
No. Well, although it was easier then, honestly.
Tell me why.
There were weirder. There are some weirder steps to doing a release back then, for sure, because the artwork was a lot crazier. Because well, that 7-inch, Jason Farrell designed it, and you know, he had to piece it all together by hand, and then we had to get the negatives done, and then they would, you know, make the print off the negatives. Where now you can do everything on a computer and send it off. But so there were some things that were a little different and more cumbersome. But now. So before, you know, I got the 7-inch made, I sold them to, you know, distributors, some stores, the band took some copies, sold it through the mail, and that was kind of it. placed an ad or two, like in Heart Attack and Punk Planet. But now, you have to kind of do the same thing. You have to do production. You have to, well, I guess there are not many magazines to do ads in anymore, but you have to sell to all the same people you did before, but then you also have to put it up on a million different websites like Bandcamp, iTunes, like, you know, all those places. You have to, like, maintain your own website. You have to, there's just, like, you have to, you know, put it up on social media, like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. And then people get in touch with you over email and, like, all these different sources, like, they're messaging about the release. And it, you know, and, of course, they don't sell as well as they used to because more people might be listening to it online. You may not be getting paid for it. But more people might hear the release than they used to in a way, but you're getting paid less and selling less. But you're doing maybe twice the amount of work on a release.
Yeah, it definitely feels like that sometimes where you're like, wait a minute, there's all this social media, there's all this website stuff. Yeah, and there's sort of a less return. But supposedly more people are listening.
Well, exactly. And I think more people are listening, which is cool. But it goes in such a like a black hole that you kind of... You know people are, but you kind of don't know. Because when you sold records, you're like, okay, this shipment of 57 inches is going to Japan. Like, this is going to that. Like, you don't really know what's happening half the time. Like,
because iTunes and Spotify have that data, not you.
Yeah, exactly. And it's getting passed around in other ways, too. So in one way, it's like, okay, it's cool, it's getting around. But on the other hand, it's just like, it's a little more thankless in a weird way. Because, I mean, I like the active, like... I think it's fun to do mail order sometimes because it's like you actually are like, oh, this is going to this person at this address. Like it's an actual kind of like, you know, it's a personal transaction.
Yeah.
So like you're sending, you're like, okay, you're picturing this person's going to put this record on, they're going to enjoy it. But now it's like, yeah, you upload to iTunes and it's just like you get an Excel sheet. You know, you're just like here's your 49 cents. You know,
yeah, right.
I don't know, and you're just like, and then sometimes you got to wonder like, are these like. Would you know if Apple could just be shooting out any number they want? Like, how would you ever know? Because, like, when you make a record, you have inventory, so you know if you're missing records. But, like, with digital stuff, you have no way to audit, like, that their numbers are correct.
And I feel like it's in, and I mention this a lot on the podcast, and it's because I'm old, but I feel like there's missing this connection. And I know that it still happens.
Definitely.
I know that there's still basement shows. I know that these things still happen. But there's that personal feeling, you saying you're writing this thing to Japan and you're sending 50 records.
Exactly.
And wow, I just sent 10, you know, packages to Japan. Maybe we should play there.
Yeah, exactly. No, it blows my mind. Like it still blows my mind when I'm like, oh, this person in China ordered a record. This is freaking awesome. You don't get that. You don't get that feeling when you get like just this like
spreadsheet.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the same. I mean, it's not sounding old. It's just true. I mean, I think anyone that's younger would agree. It's more exciting if they did it the other way too. Because I don't know. It is weird. It's also just sometimes it just feels like it's a lot more administrative work than ever before, and it can be overwhelming at times to put out a release because it's just you just feel like there's so many things you have to do.
Yeah, and now that you say it, you're right. Your first release, what was there, 7 steps?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, exactly. Now there's like 30.
Yeah.
You know. People, you put out the record, you sell them, and then you just move on to the next one. And that was kind of like maybe you'd repress it, but most of the time you just let it go and use that money to press another one. But yeah, now it just lives kind of like in so many different places, and you have to kind of maintain it. And yeah, I mean, it's not that I mind doing it the way that it's being done now, but it's harder to crank out releases. It just is, and there's also the production delays of plants being so overrun.
Well, they need to make all those major label, you know, vinyl releases.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly the problem. And once they're out of all their weird like Ghostbuster like picture discs, and
you want to know something funny about that one?
That's
the label I work for put that out.
Oh, really?
And there's one where it's like a Stay Puft, where it's like a scratch and sniff. And like I was blown away. I was like, "Oh my god, we have really gotten to the bottom."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I definitely feel that way. And I also, I mean, even today, I mean, I won't mention who, but I got a a price increase notice from one of the pressing plants, and they increased their prices last year too, and they're like, well, you know, because of rising costs. It's like, yeah, but I try to, you know, sell records at a cheaper price just to make them more accessible, and, you know, if people don't like the record, they're like, oh, they're more willing to take a chance at like $13, $14. But it's like the record plants are starting to, you know, raise their prices because they're seeing that the labels are charging $30, $40 on some of these ridiculous records. Like, but I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Like, you're killing me.
Wow.
Like, you're literally, every time you're raising your prices 5, 10%, like, it's, you know, I don't know. It's pretty frustrating.
People are buying them, though. I mean, that Ghostbusters thing was
yeah, definitely.
You know, crazy. And it's
depressing, right?
Yeah. It's sort of, I mean, my professional life is like, okay, well, that's good. I get the, you know, I can still have a job. Yeah. I mean, that's not obviously why, but like, okay, well, that's good. It's doing well. We're doing right for the market. But then my DIY brain is like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, I think
I'm torn.
At some point it's going to collapse under its own weight because record stores are going to end up getting stuck with it all. But
because, and now if everyone doesn't know this, is the reason why everyone loves vinyl is because it's non-returnable. CDs are returnable. A store could buy 30 and they only sell 15. They can send the 15 back, and guess who pays for that? The label, but not vinyl. It's a one-way. So I'm teaching everybody. It's a one-way. So that's why everyone loves it. And I think you're totally right that the labels are going to get stuck with it.
Well, and also what I've run into is, with CD stores, are obviously are more willing to take a chance, but because it was returnable. But now, you know, if I call a store and say, like, oh, we're putting out this new release, you know, and they're like, oh, my budget's spent because I bought the Ghostbusters thing for Record Store Day because they were $30 each. I needed 10 of them. So they're not, like, half the time they're like, oh, I don't know, I'll take one, or, you know, like something, maybe they took 3 or 4 on before. They just don't have the budgets because they're buying all these other high-priced records. So they have, like, a monthly budget of, like, $2,000 to buy new records a month. Like, you're just... It's hard to get in there with that.
And it's a different person that's buying that release versus an indie release. So the guy going in there looking for the Lovett records doesn't see it, but the other that's interesting. It's almost like changing the audience of the record store.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, it's weird times for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, on the flip side, things like Bandcamp have made it that people... It's an alternative in the fact that, like, if, you know, when I was growing up and I couldn't find a record, usually I would mail order records directly most of the time, like, based on, like, people doing ads and, like, you know, Punk Planet or Heart Attack or whatever, or Maximum Rock and Roll. But, you know, if I couldn't find it at the store and couldn't find the address, you just didn't get the record.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, if you want a record, you can get it in, like, seconds. So I guess, you know, there is the flip side of things like Bandcamp, which is like, well... You can find things, like the most obscure things, like instantaneously, which is cool. So that is a positive part of it.
Yeah. I would love to talk about some bands, my favorite bands on Lovett Records, and then I want you to mention some that people need to check out.
Sure.
One of my favorites, I will just start with this one just because it's off the top of my head, Sleepy Time Trio.
Great band.
Like,
one of my favorite bands, too.
There's a word that gets misconstrued, and it's called screamo, chaotic. I've never felt like a show where I thought like, well, I've felt it, but this was definitely their shows where you thought everything was going to break, but it didn't.
Or sometimes they did.
Yeah. Or it did. What, I would love the, you know, the story, how you found them, what sort of the, you know, the story behind it and sort of, I mean, if anyone hasn't checked them out, you can pause the podcast right now, check them out, and then press play again.
Definitely. It's funny because people that know the band love them for sure. So I won't say they were underappreciated by any means, but sometimes I think they don't get enough credit though. Even as the people that give them a lot of credit. I think they definitely deserve all that credit plus some, but yeah, so Shelby, who played guitar and singer in Frotis, has helped me with Lovett stuff off and on for years. And he told me about Sleepy Time Trio because he lived near one of the members And he gave me a tape, and he was like, hey, I think you check this band out. It's a great band for Lovett to put out. And he gave me a tape with some of their songs. I was just like, holy shit, this is amazing. So they had put out, I believe at that point they put out 2 7-inches, and they wanted to put out like a EP, like a 12-inch. And so I was just like, got to do this. So I remember driving to Richmond with Shelby and seeing them, and then I might be getting shows confused, but I think that show they played like a converted movie theater where they had taken all the seats out, and they used to have shows in there. But and I was just like, yeah, I want to do this. So we put out that 12-inch. That was the seventh Lovett release. And then, it's funny because those guys have been in a million Lovett bands since. Like, those guys ended up being friends and kind of family for life. So that was like probably the best release in the fact that it spawned
yeah, releases.
And just like amazing friends, and like from those friends, other friends. It just, that was definitely the best decision the label ever made, was putting out that band for sure, for multiple reasons. Like, I love those guys to death, and they all mean a lot to me. But
nice.
Yeah, but they broke up not too long after, and then we put out the CD, which was kind of a discography of all their stuff. But then they've done like little stints here and there ever since. I actually went to Japan with them a year and a half ago now, I guess. Some guy in Japan offered to bring them over.
Wow.
So I facilitated that, and then of course I was like, I'm going on this. So they do play every once in a while, and I think they're actually playing a house show in the spring. Like, their whole thing is they do shows, like, if like still if it's the right show, but they don't want to do it for the money. So they don't want to play like 500 capacity club. If someone asks like, hey, do you want to play my basement, a lot more likely they'll do it.
Wow, I love that.
Because they want to do it because they love those songs, and they just want to do it just to respect the music. So those guys are amazing.
Another favorite, 400 Years.
Yeah, which that kind of came out of Sleepy Time and too, because they toured together. So So Sleepy Time Tree and 400 Years toured a bunch. So we put out 400 Years pretty soon after Sleepy Time Trio, and they went to Europe and then toured the U.S. together and stuff. Those records are all really great. And I still talk to a couple of those guys.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then Mile Marker. Good stuff.
Mile Marker, actually, I'm working with again, funny enough.
Oh, no way. Tell us.
So Mile Marker, so Al and Dave, well, I put out, Dave's been in this band Oxes that I've been working with, but him and Al moved to Germany. I'll backtrack. So Mile Marker came about, though, because Ben Davis, who was the CP Time Trio, played in Mile Marker for a while. So then it made sense, and then they were a band, at that point they were living in Carrboro, North Carolina. And then since I was in Greensboro, it all kind of came together. So I put out the Mile Marker record, Frigid Form Cells, and then, so what happened recently is Al and Dave decided to get it going again, since they're both in Germany. They're like, we should start doing this again. So I just released a 2-song 7-inch a couple months ago that they did, and then we're reissuing Frigid on vinyl in the spring, and they actually just finished recording a new full length.
Oh, wow.
I think they finished it yesterday, actually. So that's going to get mastered in a couple weeks. And yeah, they're going to do a bunch of touring and stuff. They're going to tour the States, I think, in the late summer is the plan at the moment. So yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's crazy how some things come full circle. But yeah, they were always a band went through a lot of different lineup changes, but they're definitely one of my favorites. And that era of Mile Marker that was just really awesome. They put on really intense, awesome live shows. All three of those bands were playing around the same time, and I was really lucky because I was just like, bands all like were amazing musicians and all just put on like killer, cool live shows and toured a lot.
Yeah, so, and they were all connected.
And they all worked their asses off. Like, I mean, those. I don't even know how many shows Mile Marker did, in the 90s, but it was insane. They were, like, all those bands were constantly on tour.
Another one that I think everyone needs to pause and play if they haven't heard is Engine Down. And definitely under the pretense of present tense, that song, The Offer of Something, when I first heard it, I must have played it on my radio show every week. And then just their live show, everything about that band, I think, spawned so many other bands.
So Jonathan from Sleepy Dumb Trio was in Engine Down. So he, and then Jason Wood, who was in Engine Down, was the Sleepy Dumb Trio roadie, and he sang on one of their songs. So there's the connection again with Sleepy Dumb Trio. But yeah, the first time I saw them was actually in Greensboro. They played at a house show. Jonathan's like, hey, you know, I'm in this new band. You should come check it out. I'm like, yeah, of course. And they were doing, I think there was a little overlap with Sleepy Time there too, actually, because everyone's in the 50 bands, but it's funny, they invited me to this house show, and it was at this place, I think it was called The Broken Window, I can't remember, but literally it was like a shed behind a house, but you had to crawl through like a broken window to get in. It was it was so sketchy, it was unbelievable, it was hilarious, but yeah, so that was the first time I saw them, and I was just like, holy shit, and it was, yeah, all those early songs, and I was just like, you know, this is amazing. I have to put it out, and then they give me a demo that's like, "Don't. I hope you don't hate. Don't hate us, because these songs aren't all hashed out." I still have a demo sitting around here somewhere, and I was like, "Oh, fucking no!" And I was just blown away. So yeah, I was really lucky to work with those guys. And then I actually went to Europe with them. I went out on the road with them a couple of times.
Oh wow!
They were just amazing.
They were. I mean. As a fan watching them, it was so different, and I think it was like they it's not like they planned what they were doing, because they had the lights and they had the imagery, whatever it was. I remember seeing them, one Mac Rock or something.
But
they just had it together, and wow. I think it just showed this professionalism. But they were this indie rock band. And it kind of, I don't know, it just, it messed, it didn't mess me up. It made me sort of realize, fucking A.
Sure, yeah, it's funny about those lights. We went to Europe in late August of 2001. So we were in Europe, actually, on September 11th, 2001. And then we were actually in Germany when everything happened. It was pretty nutty. But I'm almost positive. So we brought all that stuff over on the airplane. They had all those poles. They put together all their lights themselves, and I'm almost positive we had to leave all that stuff in Europe because the plane regulations changed so fast, and we're like,
oh wow!
So it's just you can't come on the plane with a bunch of pipes, So I think all that stuff got left in Europe, if I remember correctly. But
oh, that's random.
Yeah,
and then also, the history and love of. Frotis, and of course Decahedron. What did that relationship sort of with that band, and then Shelby or Jason mean to you, and love it, and sort of just
And I still talk to those guys all the time too. I mean, I probably got five emails from Shelby today actually, and I talked to Jason a couple times a week on the phone. But yeah, so show that was Love It release number two, and Shelby definitely had a lot of input in the label early on, which was great, and. Yeah, I went on the road with those guys a couple of times too, and we had a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, those are also great, great guys, great band. And I, putting out Frotis actually, led to putting out Sleepy Time Trio. It is funny how one thing can kind of trigger of other things. So, but yeah, I mean, and then we just reissued the Frotis Weapons vinyl, which we were originally going to put out back in the day, but they had broken up, and then. I think I was just at a point with the label where, we weren't sure. We had a lot coming out, and they had broken up, and it just was a little unclear, what was going to happen with their stuff, and it just got sat on, and then it got put up by School by Ramen, because our friend Tony worked there at the time, and he got them to put it out, and then they never even really promoted it. And it's funny, because we ended up basically with the record after all this time anyway. But
wow.
And now people appreciate it. Where, you know, when they broke up at the time, the record just kind of came out and, you know, was a little bit lost, even though it's such an amazing record.
And did you feel as you were doing this label, I mean, it's been since, what, 95, 96?
Yep.
And, you know, what are some of the ebbs and flows? Were there times when you're like, I got to hang this up? Or was it just sort of a lull and then a new band would come through or you'd hear about something or, you know, a friend would mention something?
There are ebbs and flows for sure. I'm just one of those people that just doesn't give up on things. So even though it's like at times I'm just like, or is there still interest in this or whatever? Like something will come along. I kind of feel like if it's going to like die, I'll just die naturally and it'll be like obvious where it just has, it's never hit that point. I still enjoy doing it and it seems like, you know, people still enjoy, you know, maybe less than there used to be, but there are enough people that still enjoy buying the record and, you know, supporting that it's still worth it. And, you know, I've gotten a lot out of it. I mean, it's definitely changed my life just in terms of it's maybe a lot of friends for life. I got to like travel around the world with people. I've gotten to like be friends with people around the world and correspond with like really cool people and like, you know, get to go to a million shows. And I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely shaped my life in a positive way. So, it's, even though at times it seems like a huge pain in the ass, like you just feel buried in like weird stuff. Like in the end, I mean, I wouldn't change it.
Yeah. And then, you know, I think too, the Mac Rock Festival that I've talked about on the podcast and I absolutely loved going to for close to 10 years. I mean, I 10 years in a row. Being able to...
That's funny. That's probably about the number I went. I went to the first one through... Because my friend Tony, the guy that worked at Fuel My Ramen, started it. And he...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, he works at No Idea. He does the fest now in Florida.
Ah, I need to bug you about it. I kind of want to bug him about Macro. I used to...
Sure, you should do a podcast with him, actually. He's a fascinating guy.
I saved every one of the booklets that they used to give out.
Really? I probably have like 3 of them somewhere.
And I remember they were doing some doc, and they like I sent them to some college kid, and I said, please send these back, and they like never did. And then I had to like hound them, and I was like, God, you're so college, God.
Yeah, exactly. I love Mac Rock. I mean, we were the biggest supporters of it. We had showcases at it for a number of years in a row, and I was really sad when it kind of fell apart there. I guess they got it going back again, but I don't know. At this point, I feel kind of removed from that festival because it kind of seemed to go off a cliff
where
they didn't care about where it came from. So I remember about 1 year, they changed the people working at it, and they were just like, kind of like, who are you? I'm like, are you fucking serious?
Yeah.
Showcases that there's like, you know, like for 5 years in a row or whatever, we've always done ads, always done the label thing, and they just didn't seem to care. Like, and I was just like, you know, maybe it's just best to kind of be done with this one. But,
I would love. I mean, what if someone's listening has no idea what we're talking about? It was this conference at Harrisonburg, Virginia, at James Madison University. It was put on by these kids, the school.
The radio station,
WXJM. And what was amazing, I thought, was that it was that region, and it was
the Mid-Atlantic band.
Yeah, and it just you felt like you've. It was so many bands, and it was this community. You know, if it was the Spaghetti House had something at one time, or if it was the main, you know, school center, it seemed like the school was tolerant for a couple days. It was always a great label expo. It just felt like you had this community where you could meet someone, and it wasn't something that they lived in California or they lived in Germany. You could actually trade shows with them because they maybe were in Maryland too. I felt like the bands played there. And then, you know, next year you'd hear, that band's playing South by Southwest now? Like, you know, them in Mac Rock.
To me, it was like a million times better than South by Southwest than anything else because it was very focused. And like you said, you could walk between the shows and, you know, it was although it wasn't meant to just be a punk thing, but it really was in the end, you know, like it just... Yeah, it was just amazing time to like see different people you don't see, except you'd only see them at Mac Rock, and you get to see amazing bands and just so many good shows.
I remember a couple years I organized a wiffle ball game, which I thought was random. Like, you know, hey, we're going to meet on Sunday morning.
Awesome.
You know, show up. We got a wiffle ball. We're all going to play. And you know, for a couple years that was something. I remember when I worked in my first year at the first label I ever worked for, I convinced them to let me fly down. And so I remember flying to Charlottesville and renting a car, and like rolling up, and it was just like, what are those, like, this is crazy. But I had to go because, you know, friends were playing, or, you know, bands were, that I wanted to see were playing. And I just remember laughing, being like, wow, they actually let me go, to this again.
Yeah. No, I always had I have so many fun memories of that festival. It's ridiculous. It was definitely always a highlight. Like, I was just like, it's April, you know, like April's coming up. That means Mac Rock. Like this time of year when it's like,
yeah,
oh, it's like in a few months, there'll be Mac Rock. And I mean, like every one of our bands played it. And, you know, then at like, I actually convinced Fugazi to play one year.
That was an amazing show.
Yeah, because they were just like looking for a show, and I was just like, you guys should play Mac Rock. They're like, they didn't play festivals, so they were just like, well, it has to be its own separate show. Like, are you sure this is a cool thing? You know, and I was just like, yeah, like definitely. I think you guys sort up like what you guys want to do.
That still gets talked about.
Like, it was always like you get really cool bands to go there. And yeah, I always went out of my way to like preach Mac Rock to people. Like I was like, you got to play this. You got to have a label table. You know, like this is an important thing, and it was an important thing for many years.
You know what's interesting, and we'll move on because we're boring everybody. But I could talk about Mac Rock for 5 hours. The other thing I loved that Ian did when he played was he did that talk, because there were panels too, and I think that's another thing to mention.
Oh, yeah.
They were panels and they were discussions about music or how to book a show, and same thing as the show, you could go to a festival or, you know, a panel, and someone's talking about how to book your life, and I don't know, there's dumb questions, but some kid answered, maybe he started a label from it. But Ian did a talk, and I remember it was in just random ass classroom, and he was so fucking cool the whole time, just answering questions and, you know, talking. And it was just, I mean, for me, being, you know, independent scene, and that, you know, it was sort of, you know, hearing someone very fucking important talk.
it was definitely, they had a lot of different parts of that thing, which were cool.
Did you convince Ian to do that talk or that panel?
I don't remember that part. I mean, I remember the talk, but I don't remember how that came about, honestly. So I can't.
But the show, you convinced him to.
Yeah, well, they were like, are you sure this is like a cool thing to do? Because, you know, none of those guys had ever gone, and they're, you know, I was just like, yeah, you should definitely do this.
That's awesome. Yeah. You're like,
yeah. There's actually, it's funny. There's actually a this festival. It's kind of sidetracking for a second, but there's this festival in Iceland I've gone to 5 times now called Iceland Airwaves. It kind of has a similar, it's feel in a way to Mac Rock. The bands are definitely a little different, but they, Reykjavik's a pretty small town, so everything's like downtown and walkable.
Ah. I think
6,000 tickets to it or something, but it's all at all different venues downtown, so you just walk between all the different shows and stuff, and then, you know, the shows go on till like 4 a.m, and it just, I don't know, they do have like panels and stuff too during the day, and they have shows, like, they also have like shows just at like clothing stores or like just all over downtown during the day. Like at night, it's like the official, like you're supposed to have a badge to get into like the club, like all the different clubs that partake. But during the day, you can see all those same bands at like a shoe store or like a restaurant, or like the whole downtown's taken over by the festival. And it's just, it's cool because it's all these random different venues and stuff that normally aren't venues. And
wow.
Yeah.
So you're right, because I remember,
in a small way.
Yeah, because I remember there was a restaurant that I saw Coheed and Cambria play for the first time.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, this was a restaurant for, you know, 362 days of the year.
Yeah, exactly. That's why this thing in Iceland gives me that feel, where it's just like, they definitely, like, everyone partakes. Like, everyone in the town is, like, into music that weekend. I kind of felt that about Harrisonburg. Like, it took over the town in a good way. Like, it was just like there was music everywhere, and it was beautiful.
And I love that, you know, I do feel like that vegan restaurant that, you know, everyone was, you know, lined down the block for,
little,
or the
little girl,
yeah, little girl, or the cabbies at the school, even everyone was like, it's cool.
yeah, exactly.
I'm telling you, I think they got kids to go to that school because of Mac Rock.
Oh, I'm sure of it. I mean, that's the same reason. I mean, there were definitely people that went to Guilford because of the radio station.
Yeah. I think, you know, you're right. That sort of feeling of that venue that isn't a venue is one for a couple days, and then it goes back.
I love still going to shows that are at non-show spaces. Those shows to me are a lot more fascinating than going to see a band play in a bar.
Yeah. You know, I think too, and I want to talk about Discord and a little bit, but also, you know, the sort of scenes that you were running the label through had an interesting, you know, time period. Just because, you know, late 90s, you know, started the word emo, or even the, you know, the punk scene that was sort of, those bands were getting bigger, you know, and selling lots of records. And then mid 2000s, you know, crazy boom. On your side, when you were still doing your things, were you feeling that? Were you sensing certain thoughts, or was it, I don't even notice it and I'm doing my own thing?
I noticed it. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, there were, like, you know, a lot of the bands were getting approached and stuff. Like, Engine Down ended up putting that record, that last record, well, I did the vinyl, but they put out the CD version on Lookout. And then, I mean, it was definitely, like, you know, there was definitely, I think, you could sense it around you for sure. Just because there was a lot more money in the scene than previous, and everyone was trying to, like, you know, find that band.
Yeah.
Definitely. I don't know. I don't know if, like, we sold more records at the time or anything like that, but I think there was this sense of, like everything's getting a little bigger. I mean, most of the bands, I think we were talking about the Refuse thing before the podcast a little bit, but, like, a lot of the bands that kind of got big that I was friends with seemed to get big after the fact more than when they were an actual band. So it's kind of hard to say. But, I mean, it was nice, like, bigger, but there were always bands that were bigger, like Thursday, who would take our bands out on tour because they were fans of our band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, Thursday would be like, Engine Down, come do some shows with us, or Del Cielo, come do some shows with us. Like, some bands that were getting bigger who had actually started as fans of our band, like, we're, you know, being appreciative towards them, which was cool. Actually, skipping back to Mac Rock for a second,
yeah,
a really funny story is this band, the Rob Ross, who's totally underappreciated, who everyone should check out if you haven't heard it. They're just totally insane. And the live, you'd have to try to find some live footage of them. But they played a house show at Mac Rock one year in this basement, you know, like, next to a washer and dryer, basically, or whatever, and an amazing show. They used to do all these R&B cover songs. They would cover, like, R. Kelly or, like, Genuine, and, like, it was total madness, I'll just say. But that band, The Faint, were playing Mac Rock that year, and The Faint actually started more as, like, kind of like a punk band.
I remember that show.
So they were kind of a different style than when they got big. So The Faint actually saw the Rob Ross and were blown away, and they actually changed their style. They told the Rob Ross this years later. They had them play a show or two with them, and then they were like, "Man, that show at Mac Rock you guys played, that, like, changed the way we thought about music and what we wanted to play." And yeah, The Faint got big off of it.
Wow, I did not.
Yeah,
know
they directly told them. They're like, "Yeah, that show made us, like, change our musical style." I was like, "It's crazy."
Yeah, you're right, because The Faint, we're told that first record's like a punk record.
Yeah.
And then the next one is, you know, Dance Party USA.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So there were things that were kind of directly, but, yeah.
So we can blame Mac Rock for that.
Exactly. Blame Mac Rock for everything.
And then I think, too, I mean, you now, you do Love It Records, and then you also work at Discord, correct?
Yep.
And then you've been doing that since 2002.
I guess that sounds about right.
Yeah. What? How did that come about? I know that Discord Love It. Is that how it started?
Yeah. So Discord distributed all the Lovett stuff. And then, so I used to be in there all the time, and then this gets kind of convoluted. My friend Melissa, she used to work at Lumberjack, which was a distributor, I don't know if you remember.
Yes.
Who my friend Eric started, and he also did Art Monk Construction.
Oh, I loved Art Monk!
Yeah, so he did both those things.
Ah.
And then, so my friend Melissa, who I met through this, so I used to take my records over to like Lumberjack too, and they would sell my records. So then Melissa worked over there, got to be friends with her, and then at some point she got a job at Discord. I think she was an intern at DeSoto, and I think then Kim recommended her for a job at Discord. So anyway, so at some point she was at Discord, and then they basically needed like some part time help. So she recommended, she's like, we should get Brian to come in and do that stuff. So then, you know, Ian offered to, like, basically, he was like, could do some part-time work? And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, you could always use some extra work when you're doing a record label, obviously. So I started working there part-time, and then it became full-time. I mean, basically, Ian's like, we saw your stuff. Like, if you're able to incorporate the two things, like, you can use the resources over here and then do your Lovett stuff, too. And he was just always so generous about the whole thing. So then I started working over there full-time, but able to do Lovett while I was there, like, kind of intermix some stuff. So I've been over there for a while, and then Melissa left for a while. But then I actually brought her back about a year and a half ago.
Oh, nice.
So it kind of flipped. Yeah, she left and took a different job, but then some staffing changed around at Discord. So I was like, you want to come back? So it's kind of funny. I've been there the longest now.
Oh, wow. Now, how have your jobs, morphed or changed? I mean, I've worked at indie labels, so you kind of have seven different jobs. Equal Vision, I think I had like six.
Exactly.
But is that how you guys kind of have it split up? Is it sort of a, everyone's kind of got...
Well, Discord's interesting in the fact that it's kind of two companies. There's Discord Records and there's Discord Direct. Discord mm-hmm. Direct is the distribution wing. That goes back to the, this might be boring to some people, but Southern U.S. and Southern England used to manufacture and distribute Discord stuff. Discord Direct was set up because Discord wanted to always be to sell their stuff directly to stores and at the cheapest possible price. So Discord Direct used to buy the records from Southern, like Southern would manufacture them, Discord Direct would buy them to sell to like Discord's direct zone stores, and then pay Southern, who would then pay the royalty back on it or whatever. But so Discord Direct was always there because Ian and Jeff always thought it was important for people to have a direct route if they wanted to go to it, so they didn't have to go to a one stop or go through Southern or whatever. They wanted people to be able to call Discord and buy the stuff wholesale. If you were a kid selling at a show, or you're a legit store, so they wanted to have that outlet. It was really important to them. So. Southern now is long gone. So Discord Direct still exists, but Discord Direct actually does all the distribution, like sells to like all the distributors and then.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then Discord Records, obviously exists as a label and does all the production and stuff on the records. So,
so you go back and forth between Discord Direct and then the record label.
Yeah, everyone has kind of worked for everything. It's kind of funny because within the office, it's just kind of, you don't really think about what you're doing. everyone just does, there's a lot of, obviously, it's two different sets of books and it's two different companies, but it's through everyone, obviously has to do stuff for both. I mean, technically, I'm the, label manager for Discord Records, but I do... more than enough stuff to Discord Direct too. So.
You were about to say, I do a lot of shit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just like everyone has to do everything. I mean, in the end, I guess, I deal with some of the bigger picture stuff than maybe some other people do, but everyone pitches in and does everything. So, yeah, so I do that, but luckily, it's been... in the age of laptops and you know, iPhones and iPads and everything else, you're just kind of always connected. So I'm doing with both Levin and Discord basically at all hours, kind of equally. But, you know, and everyone, at, you know, it's kind of intertwined. Like, I try to keep people in the office are all at Discord are really nice about, you know, like, everyone, like, pitches in on Levin stuff at, if need be, too. So
that's rad. And then,
yeah, some stuff I try to keep, some stuff I try to keep separate on purpose just because I want to, you know, I want it to be my thing, but there's like plenty of things where it's not separate.
Yeah. And then, you know, I think, I mean, if you've hit Indie Rock Jackpot, it's working for Discord and having a label distro through them. What's sort of your favorite thing about working with, because that label to me is, and there are labels before them, but you know, for the, my generation or my things is that's the gold standard. For, you know, if it's pricing or aesthetic or going about your day, going about your life.
Well, definitely. I mean, if you told, like, junior high me that, you know, me at this age would be doing, you know, working at Discord and having a lot of responsibility, I would be like, you know, like, fuck you, that's crazy. So, but it, I mean, when I step back from it, it still does seem crazy to me. Just because, yeah, it was, like, a huge influence on me growing up. Like, everything Discord did was, like, it couldn't do any wrong to me.
What's most satisfying about working there and being a part of it?
I mean, you're part of history. I mean, you're definitely a part of something that's changed, you know, touched and changed so many people's lives, like, around the world. I mean, you can't really overstate the, you know, like what Discord has done over the years. I mean, obviously you can find millions of random people in the world that have no idea like what it is, but you could also find millions of people that have actually been like, it's actually, they have a real connection and have been affected by something that Discord has put out or done, which is, you know, it's crazy. And, you know, some days you just like, when you step back, you're like, oh, that's weird. Like, yeah, you just, I mean, you kind of, obviously you have to work in the present and you know, we do a lot of catalog stuff, obviously, but we're still, you know, we're still doing stuff for that day. But when you think about, like, the history of the label, it's pretty insane, for sure. And just to be around it, like, on a daily basis is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
We get a lot of visitors that come in and they, like, freak out. And then, like, sometimes you kind of just forget because it's obviously a job. And the fact that, you know, you go to it every day and you work a certain number of hours and, you know, you have a routine, and then some days you just don't really think about what you're doing. You don't think, like, oh, like, I'm pulling these, like, you know, original Minor Threat Master tapes for some reason. You're just like, you kind of, do-do-do, and you just, you know, you're just doing whatever, and you don't think,
yeah,
I'm sorting these test pressings that are probably worth $10,000 or whatever, and you're not really thinking about it, but then someone will come in from, like, Peru and just, like, start, like, freaking out, like how happy they are to be, like, the office and like see the Discord house and get a picture, and then you realize, you know, it kind of hits you again, like, oh shit, like this is a really special thing to be a part of.
I definitely
don't take it for granted at all, but there are, you know, you just kind of get in your routine and you just don't think about what you're doing some days, and then you know, it's a pretty common occurrence that someone will come in and be like really overwhelmed by stopping by, and you then you're like, oh yeah, that was me when I was a teenager.
Yeah, I think to the, yeah, someone stopping by, or I know a friend's band, I think it was this past summer, had a photo with Ian in front. It was my friend's band, Rough Francis, and they're one of the members, or a few of the members in the band, their relatives and parents were in death, and so they were kind of being like, oh my God, I remember them texting me. They're like, Tommy, we're in front of this. Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like we see, like, we're across the street. The office is right across the street from the house. So if we see,
like a van pull up?
Yeah, like we're, like, we see people getting a picture outside the house. Like, we'll be like, oh, they're taking a picture. We'll, like, you know, we'll, like, be like, hey, do you want us to take that picture? Or, like, if Ian, like, hears people and he's not, like, you know, on a phone call or doing something, he'll come out and, like, get pictures with them or, like, give them a quick tour or whatever. Like, we all try to be, like...
Because that's really cool about it. That, just to hear that, because that means that that random-ass band And maybe 10 years from now, whatever, something else happens and he's making a decision. And I'm not saying that, I'm not sure if I'm explaining this correctly, but I feel like it just puts this in this right mindset. Like, I went here, this is what this means. Someone came out, they talked to me for 2 minutes. That meant the world. I'm going to go and try and be that too.
Well, exactly. No, I mean, fully. And we definitely understand that. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying about, like, people helping when I started the label. Like, you know, I remember that. And I feel like I have to pass that on, because, and hope that, you know, the person I've done that for will do the same thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, in the end, we're all, you know, you got to treat people with respect. And, you know, it's just the right thing to do. I mean, it's like, we can always take 5 minutes out of our day to, you know, help someone take a picture outside, or like give them a quick tour of the office, or, you know, whatever. Like, you know, you don't want to close the blinds and be like, oh, let's pretend like we didn't see that person quick.
Get away, kid.
Yeah.
We're making gold records in here, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, honestly, I'd say 99% of people are like really nice and like awesome to come and visit. I mean, there have been definitely a couple weirdos over the years that are like, Jesus, but you know, like for the most part, everyone's like super cool and like, and nice and respectful, which is cool.
Well, I think it's absolutely amazing that, you know, I've, you know, love it. And I think you put out some amazing records. And when I put this up, everybody that's listening, I'll have some links up to some bands that everyone needs to check out. And, you know, you shaped how I've sort of listened to music and created music. And I think you going then to Discord, it's almost like you're able to do it even bigger.
Yeah, it 100% is. I'm glad to be a part of it. And I'm glad it's still kicking around too.
Because you need a job.
Yeah. No, I can find another job. But yeah, I don't know. It's the same thing with Love It. You just never know like when something's going to stop. But, it'll, you know, everything has a life cycle. But I'm glad that, you know, that Discord's been able to continue on, and that, you know, everyone's going to see it keep going. Because it means a lot to a lot of people. So.
Definitely. Hope you have a good rest of your night, and
you
really, really appreciate this chat, and it meant a lot that you took time to do this.
Of course. Well, thank you.